And at this time, Monica is going to share her experience on step one.
Take it away. Thank you, Sherry. Hi, everyone. My name is Ronica. I'm an alcoholic. How's that sound? Is that good? Okay, I'm just kind of moving this thing because it's kind of like the octopus arm in my view. So I always pray before I speak because it's better that way because I do have a big ego. And so my favorite prayer is the seventh step prayer. So I'm going to just close my eyes for a minute and say that. Thank you. So step one. So I like to say I have experience with these steps. I haven't completed the steps. I have experience with them. Because if I follow the directions in this book, steps 10, 11, and 12 will be a course of action that I continue for the remainder of my life. So even though I have had experience with working with women and being fortunate enough to hear someone's fifth step, that doesn't mean I've completed all those steps. That's me. Because the minute I think I've completed something, it's kind of like graduation and I can move on and not have to work as hard, maybe. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was involved with someone who was a very, very, very bad drug addict. And I was not the problem, so it was very easy for me to go with him for a while and say he was the problem. And I was going to other fellowships. And then one day I was sitting in a fellowship and we happened to be reading the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the light bulb went off and said, you're an alcoholic. So I was going to AA meetings, got a sponsor, and, you know, danced around, did some step work, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You know, and my biggest experience with the steps was reading those 12 steps, you know, how it works and those, you know, those types of AA meetings that I would go to that would just read a lot of literature before the meeting even started, right? So that was about my most educational view on the steps. So my step work had basically been, first I tried writing an autobiography about what the world had done to me, and the computer somehow halfway through it, I lost it. That was very resentful making. And then I started writing, answering some questions and some worksheets and checking boxes. You angry? Yep, check. Jealous? Yep, check. You know, so that was really helpful. But it was helpful to the point that it kept me in the game. So about 4+ years in the game, I was introduced in 1996 to the Sharon, Massachusetts Thursday night Women's Big Book Step Study meeting. And I walked in and it was very small. And, you know, when they read the group conscience, all I heard was, you're not good enough, you can't share. That's all I heard. I could not hear anything anybody else said because I was too busy taking everybody else's inventory. So being a good, stubborn alcoholic, I continued to go to that meeting, I don't know, 7, 8 weeks, I don't know. And I also continued to be bad-mouthed in the meeting, right after the meeting, outside in the parking lot, to any woman that would allow me to talk. So then, of course, I stopped going because that meeting was useless. Oh, no, no. I asked a woman to sponsor me, right? And she's like, yeah, call me. She gave me some directions, I don't know. And I'm used to, like, sponsorship where it's life coaching. I call you up, tell you all my crap. You listen, right? There was no discussion of any steps with the people that I had been working with before. She basically hung up on me. She's like, I'm not here to listen to your stuff. If you want to do this work, call me. So you know what that meant. Just a perfect, oh, she's so mean. She doesn't understand me. That meeting thinks they're better than me. So of course I stopped going and proceeded to grind my life even more into the ground, sober. And everything on the outside was looking perfect. I had gotten accepted to law school. I got a almost a half scholarship to go to law school, which is kind of unheard of. I had a nice guy in my life, but, you know, miserable. I got pregnant, and I did not have a baby because we did not get married, so you know where that went. And I found myself going to this particular meeting on Saturday mornings. It was not a Big Book Step Study meeting. It was not an AA meeting. It was a different fellowship. And as I was driving home every Saturday morning, after I took the entire room's inventory, angry, I would drive home. And in March, I found myself looking at these trees that were really big. And I remember one particular March, it was rainy, and I saw this oak tree, this giant tree, and it was on a curve. And I thought to myself, how fast do I have to go to make sure that I kill myself? Because the worst thing that could happen to me would be that I ended up paralyzed in a bed. And that's the thoughts that have gone through my head. And probably very, very, very soon after that, a woman showed up. A woman showed up at that particular meeting from the Norton Big Book Step Study Group. And the only reason she was at that Saturday meeting because the Norton Church had something going on. So she came in. I do not remember a word of what she said. And the only reason I remember her name is because her and I lived in the same town and were going to several meetings together that I would see her a couple times a month. I sat in the back, started like this, like I always did, angry at the world because I really hated myself. And I was bawling and I asked her to help me and she said yes. But, that's the caveat, I go to these Big Book Step Study meetings and you have to be willing to go to at least one a week. I don't care, you can go to any of the kind of meetings you want to go to. All right, so I show up at Norton, which is a very large room. If anybody's been there, it's bigger than this room, a little bit bigger. And I'm sitting up along the wall, and for the next couple months, I don't know what anybody's saying when they shared, but I was crying. Because for the first time, like my sponsor's husband would say, I heard the dog whistle. My soul heard that dog whistle, right? And I didn't even know it. So we proceeded. My experience at the time with step one was to read a couple of chapters and get with her and read those chapters with her. And we did one chapter at a time. That was my experience. Some people might read a little bit more. It doesn't really make a difference. It's about coming to God and doing the work and being willing. So, of course she tells me I need to start at the Roman numerals, right? I'm like, nobody reads the Roman numerals in a book. What is that about? Fine. And you need to get a dictionary. You need to look up words that you don't know, whatever, and words that you can't really get a really good definition for. Well, don't you know who I am? And the other part of it is I can kind of figure out what a word means by reading the sentence. For the most part, there was maybe a couple of words that I didn't know. So I remember our first meeting was the doctor's opinion, right? I'm sitting there, and she's like, well, what does that word mean? For instance, hopeless. No hope. Oh, no, 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 no. First of all, you cannot use a definition that has the word in it itself. And literally, she had a dictionary and she slid it over to me. So for the next 2 hours, she sat there, the patience of that woman to sit there with this obstinate, self-will run riot alcoholic to sit there while I looked up words. So the definition I now have for hopeless is no possibility of a solution. So in the foreword to the first edition, it says, we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless, no possibility of a solution, state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book, to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body. It doesn't say to stop drinking. It doesn't say to stop drinking. I was not drinking when I was thinking of driving into that tree at 100 miles an hour. I had been separated from all substances. for over 4 years when I was thinking of how fast I'm going to have to drive into that tree. So we read these pages together, and that was my experience, right? So what I share with you about the doctor's opinion comes from years of coming. I go to all types of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I don't differentiate from open meetings or regular AA. They're all AA meetings. This is an AA meeting. The only difference with this is a big book step study AA meeting. We follow the directions in the book. But I go to all types of AA meetings, and I get help at all types of AA meetings. Some meetings are more helpful than others. And some days, maybe I'm supposed to be more helpful than others at some of the meetings. But I'm supposed to carry a message of hope. And sometimes I'm the only one, just like you. Sometimes we're the only ones who have experienced the spiritual experience that we get out of this book to talk to other alcoholics. So we read this together, and most of it did not resonate until I did later work. And I found now I can really understand these words in these pages. So, you know, I read a book on Dr. Silkworth. So in 1899, he did his medical internship at a hospital which would later become Bellevue. And he worked in he liked the alcoholic ward, because he was convinced that there was something else with these alcoholics. He was not convinced that it was an organic brain disease that could not be cured. He was certain there was something else. But back then, that was not the case. The belief was, there is no help for these people. It was like, let's lock them up. And I'm sure everyone's heard the stories of locking them up in the asylums and all the things that they did, and just put them away and pretend they don't exist. And Silkworth was not of that ilk. So he would go on to get his own practice, to do all kinds of work, but he would always come back to these alcoholics. So he ends up in Towns Hospital, which was in New York, and that was a very high-end detox for drunks and drug addicts. And Bill shows up. Not once, not twice, three times. Bill used to have his own room. Bill would show up and he'd go down the hall, Bill, your room's ready. So he's watched these guys, the real alcoholics, and he could not help them. And so this, I find this writing amazing. So he talks about, the first thing he's pointing out here is, you know, he had come to regard Bill as a person who was hopeless, no possibility of a solution. And then Bill shows back up, and he sees that all of this, the talking and all the things that they work together on, he sees Bill. All of a sudden, now Bill's like thinking about other people, and he sees that this part of this treatment was to give this message to other people. And he, in the next four pages, he talks about that at least once. Altruism, selflessness, no profit motive, that these people that part, and he says right here, this, you know, as part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present these conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. You know, what we know now about carrying the message, this idea that this doctor saw, that he saw Bill, and somehow Bill didn't just like wake up one day and get smart. It was really, I feel, his willingness and being God-inspired. Because Ebby, who he believed was a worse drunk than him, who got exposed to the Oxford group, came to carry him a message. And he, you know, when Ebby shows up, he's like, oh, this is great, we're going to get drunk together. And then Ebby shows up and he's not drinking. He goes, here, have a drink. And Ebby's like, no. And he's like, what? Because he had told himself if he ever was as bad as Ebby, he would get help. So Ebby's like not drinking, and he's like, what is going on? He's like, I got religion. So Bill's like, because he's an atheist. He's an agnostic, maybe an atheist, right? But Ebby doesn't do any preaching. All he talks about is his own experience. And Bill can listen, because he knows where Ebby came from. And, you know, there's no demonstration. I mean, words can say all kinds of stuff, right? I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't know how many times people are like, oh, why are you doing that? Or don't do this? Or have you tried this? Or how come you're doing that? And that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when I watch somebody change, and I know what they were like, that is the big sales pitch right there. So Ebby's in front of him, and Ebby is bringing this message to him. So now Bill is doing the same thing, and the doctor is getting to see this. He's watching Bill change, right? And he's saying, I know so many of these people that other methods failed. So I'm going to say, you can rely on him. You know, and the allergy thing, when I first read about the allergy thing, I was like, that is like the stupidest thing. Like, you know, I'd go to other AA meetings and some wise ass would be like, sorry, I swore. But some wise guy would be like, oh yeah, when I drink, I break out in handcuffs. And I'm like, that is like the stupidest thing, right? Because that's not the allergy they're talking about. It, you know, so I looked up the word allergy because my idea of an allergy was my brother had an allergy, right? If he ate peanuts or apples when he was young, he couldn't eat apples. His throat would get all scratchy and stuff. I did not break out in a rash when I drank. I did not get hives. My throat didn't close up. So I got a really good definition that I like. It says a hypersensitive reaction to environmental factors that doesn't affect most people. So when I drank, I have that hypersensitive reaction that most people don't have. I can't stop, and I make really harmful. It's the tunnel vision. It's the bull with the red cape. I can't see anything else, and I'm going to drive myself into that sword, chasing that cape. So, and Bill here mentions the altruistic plane, right? So then the doctor writes some more. And he talks about the unselfishness of these men, right? No profit mover. And even him, from what I remember, I don't think Silkworth was a big religious guy. But even here, when Bill wrote this, they believe in themselves and still more in the power. And that power, in the doctor's opinion, he's talking about is the capital P. That's God. That's not the power that I'm looking for, the one that I think I have. So I love this thing. He's writing this letter, and he goes, later he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients, and with some misgivings, we consented. Can you imagine, like, the lush bag Bill who comes in and, you know, can't stay sober, and he's like, oh, can I come talk to your other patients? They're like, all right. But what ended up happening, which was amazing to me, that Silkworth, who was definitely inspired by God and did not have a big ego, saw that these alcoholics, when they started coming into the drunk ward, actually were helping these other guys. So eventually, this ward was mostly lay people. They had very limited medical staff, and a lot of the doctors in the hospital got really resentful because they weren't allowed to come into that wing. It was Silkworth, maybe a couple of nurses, and all the drunks would come in there, so they'd get the prospects, and they did what they called the spin cycle. They'd come in for like 3 or 5 and then spin them out. But they would basically, you want to get better? Then come with us. And they had a 75% rate of people getting sober. They might not have gotten stayed sober the first time, about 50% of them, and then the other 25 would usually come around. You're lucky we have a 7%. What, we have 5% chance of people staying clean and sober now? Maybe. So, you know, to me, the most important thing that I got out of this paragraph, this reading, is men and women drink essentially because they like the effect. And I looked up the effect, and that is the result. So I like the result of alcohol. My result was I didn't hate myself. I could forget. I didn't feel bad. And I didn't care. Right? That was the result I liked. The sensation, that feeling was so elusive, right? Hard to grasp. I'm chasing it. Chasing it, chasing it. Because the more I did, the more I needed so that I could stop hating myself. And I didn't know that's what it was, because I had that uneasiness of mind and spirit, right? But it tells me why I drink. Because I'm restless, uneasy, always in motion, bringing no repose, agitated, roving, unsettled, abnormally sensitive, restless. That's me. Right? Irritable, easily provoked or exasperated. Impatient, susceptible to irritation, responsive to stimuli, and discontented, unsatisfied, unfulfilled. That is why I drank. Now, I don't know about everyone else's history growing up and things like that. You know, I believe most people in AA have gone through some difficult situations in their life, be it as children or teenagers or whatever. And those would sound like good reasons for why I drank. But I did all kinds of work to resolve a lot of that stuff. And those things weren't going on in my life anymore. I drank because that is that internal discontent, right? A friend of mine said the ism, internal spiritual malady. I drank because I have an internal spiritual malady. I'm irritable, restless, and discontented. And that's all inside. This is my belief, or just, you know, because so I kind of need to change my thinking a little bit, right? Because allergy, you know, I'm thinking rash and stuff. I think I'm irritable, restless, and discontented. And that really, even though it doesn't physically manifest, it kind of does, but it doesn't manifest like hives, right? But it manifests in my body that I'm anxious. It's just like if I had a rash, right? I don't know about, like, I got poison sumac really bad when I was a kid 1 year. Don't scratch it. It's going to spread because it's all oozy and stuff like that. Don't touch it. Well, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like this, right? I'm not thinking about it. And that's what that irritation was like for me with the alcohol. I was so unsettled inside. And it was like, you know, looking for relief. And I don't even know it. And then what happens? What he says is, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. And if I can't experience a sense of comfort and ease, I'm going to drink again. So step one is I'm powerless over alcohol. And that's a hyphen, the dash, two separate sentences. My life is unmanageable. Not because I drank. My life is unmanageable, period. And that's because of the unmanageability, I'm looking for relief. So he tells me that this is going to keep going on and on. And I thank God that as many times as it went on, I survived myself enough to get to AA. That's the ticket in the game, right? Book says we don't have a monopoly on God, because the answer is God. If I could have found God without having to write this soul-searching, stick an ice pick in my spirit, looking at all this stuff about myself, I would have. But I could not tap into that power and allow it to work through me. So he's saying, you know, the other thing that, you know, people say, oh, the steps are just a suggestion. I'm like, they're not a suggestion. That's like telling somebody that they should, you know, come up for air when they're swimming underneath the water. Right? That's a suggestion. Don't stay down too deep. You know, I watched this movie, The Maverick. I think it was called Chasing the Maverick. It was about this kid that was a surfer. And he eventually became a great surfer. But he was always chasing the thrill. And he would go down and see how far deep he would stay. And eventually, it was a true story. And eventually, he died because he would go down really deep and try to come back up. And one of the times he went down too deep and he didn't time it right and he didn't have enough oxygen, he drowned. Right? That's me. Gonna risk it until I drown. So it's not a suggestion. The psychic changes to make my soul and mind different. And they're telling me, and he says, and once it occurs, the same person who seemed doomed, who had many problems, all of a sudden is different. So what are the simple rules? Rules are standards or guides. A fixed course of action. That's the steps. right? That's the steps. A standard or guide, a fixed course of action to bring about a psychic change. And this guy was not an alcoholic. And he wrote this in here. And he faced a lot of repercussions from the medical society because he was saying, no, no, you guys, it's not incurable organic disease that these people have. It's an illness of mind and body that can be, you know, I don't think he used the word cured, but maybe we can talk about like remission, right? I'm in remission from my untreated alcoholism if I do this work. So, you know, he goes on, and I, you know, that's basically the stuff that I think is really what really was poignant for me was that I know why I drink, because I'm irritable, restless, and discontented, and then it manifests physically for me, and it creates like a physical desire to get relief, just like my poison sumac. And I found alcohol and other substances could ease that, but it was never enough. And the more I took, the more I needed, and the more I hated myself. So that leads us into the next part of step one, which is my thinking, the unmanageability of my thinking, right? So this is why I drink. It's my thinking. You know, I love Jim the car salesman. Love him, right? Because it's me. He's me. You know, I mean, so alcoholics, what am I like? You know, I'm blame shifters and guilt transfer. I blame everybody. So, you know, this self-deception, the experimentation, all these ways to think of like, I'm going to control and manage. I'm going to move. I'm going to get married. I'm going to get divorced. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make money once. Nothing. Nothing. You know, nothing. So the first example, you know, the guy that had been sober for a long time. So, you know, I think it's, they talk about the guy with, you know, the many years, right? 30 years, I think it is. And then he drinks again. I think that's telling me, like, it doesn't make a difference how long I'm away from it. Because once I don't have the physical craving, so whatever amount of time it takes to detox, right? I don't know, a couple months, really detox, right? Dr. Bob, it took him 2 years before he didn't have cravings, right? So whatever it takes. Once I don't have the physical cravings, then if it was alcohol was just the problem, I would not drink again, right? There's no reason. But I'm looking for that relief from that spirit that's broken. So, you know, that guy drinks and he's dead. But Jim is my favorite guy because I can relate to him. So it tells me, it says here, how can we describe to people to our own satisfaction if they're one of us? So the experiment, you know, like I would never tell anybody today, why don't you go, you know, because there's people that I know, they're not just alcoholics. A lot of them have other substances there, and some of the substances that they're messing with are like, they could be very lethal. So I'm not going to go, oh yeah, you should go out and try it and see if it works. You know, so, but I don't fight with people. I mean, I can't, you know, I just tell them my experience. So how are we going to explain this to people that they can better? But Jim, I think, so they're saying, so we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. For obviously, this is the crux, and the crux, I looked that word up because, you know, it's the decisive point of the problem. Well, it's not obvious to me that my thinking was the problem. It was my mother, my brother, the job, the this, you know. Oh, they put me in the special class when I was in fifth grade. They told everybody I was stupid. You know, all these other problems, right? So what kind of thinking dominates their mind? Let's look at Jim. Love Jim. Like I've said it like seven times now, sorry. So this is my theory. I'm sticking to it. You can believe it, not agree. So we have Jim, right, who has a good World War record. That's World War I. He did no drinking until after he came back from World War I. What does that sound like? Post-traumatic stress, maybe? So first of all, nobody's talking about that in early 20s and 30s, right? You're going to go and tell somebody that you're having nightmares and you can't sleep, and you know, and there's nothing to address that. And then the other thing too, you know, 80, 90 years ago, men didn't talk about problems. You know, our society can still be like that sometimes with certain groups and stuff. Oh, no, right? So he comes back. He did no drinking until after he came back from the war. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. They got a nervous disposition, okay? He becomes so violent when he's intoxicated. They commit him. He loses his business, almost loses his family. He comes to be with the AA guys, and it says he made a good beginning. It was good for a while. He made a good beginning, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So I have no idea what a good beginning means. Did he write a four-step? Did he start making amends? Did he stop going to the group, stop helping guys? Who knows? But he made a good beginning. And then he was just back into the cycle again. And he knew, just like all of us knew, you're going to get fired, you're going to go to jail, you're going to lose, you know, your kids are going to get taken away. Like, the list goes on. Yeah, I won't do it again. Yeah. Here he is, but he got drunk again. So tell us about it, Jim. Lying alcoholic, right? I came to work on Tuesday, and I remember I felt irritated. Remember, irritable, restless, discontented? So he's irritated that he had to be a salesman for a business he once owned. Do you think he's just a little irritated? I'd be in there in my head, you know what I'd be saying, because first, they stole it from me, they're ruining the business, all the stuff I'd tell myself why it's not my fault I lost the business, because you stole it from me. Then on the flip side, the fear would be, if I piss them off, if I don't sell enough cars, they're going to fire me. This is during the Depression. He's already lost his job a couple times. He's lost his family a couple of times. He lost his business. So he's got anger and fear going on. Gee, the first two things we write about in a four-step. Right? So he's lying to himself. Like, come in, I just had a few words with the boss. Oh, yeah, I know what I minimize stuff or I over-exaggerate. There's no, like, reality when I'm in my untreated alcoholism thinking. So, a few words with the boss. What do you think that looks like? Then what does he say? Then he does what all alcoholics do, runs away. I'm just going to go to the country and find somebody to buy a car. So that's perfect. I blame somebody, yell at them, and then run away. And then he's now, because the fear's cropping up, I got to go sell a car. This is my take. I got to go sell a car, because if I don't go sell a car and get some money in here, they're going to fire me again. But if I you know, smooth it over, we can just, you know, because I'm going to pretend nothing's wrong. Because I don't know how many times did I say, oh, I was wrong, I'm sorry, before I did this work. A few. And it was always, I'm sorry, but if you had been nicer to me, I'm sorry, but if you hadn't stole my business, I wouldn't have yelled at you, right? So he takes off, convinces himself it's okay to go to a bar. Because when he wasn't angry and full of fear, he didn't have a problem. But he can't see that part. All he's thinking, it's not a big deal. I can go. I've been there before. And next thing you know, he's drinking. But that's my alcoholic mind. I'm full of fear or anger. Usually the two combined really well together. And then I'm out. And then the next thing, I'm looking for something to take it off. So that's precise definition of the word of insanity. Sanity is soundness of mind. Simple as can be. Insanity. I do not have soundness of mind. So the thought that the guy stole from me, there's no gratitude that I'm really lucky that they're letting me come back and work here. So, you know, and then we get into the jaywalker, which when I was a kid, I was like, this is when I was a kid, when I was young and when I was coming to meetings, and I'd be like, this is like a stupid story, jaywalker, right? And then I had this 17-year-old girl that I was sponsoring years and years ago, and we're reading this together, and she goes, jaywalker, that must be how I look to my family every time I go back out. And I was like, ding, you know, like a jaywalker. You know, why would you run in front of a fire truck when you know it's going to break your back? Why would you go to a bar when you know that it's a dangerous place to go? And then we get into Fred. And I think that these different stories are really good examples of, these are people that life, you know, you got Jim, who lost something, but he was still working, and his family had come back. And, you know, Fred's intelligent, he's a good business person, but his ego's not going to let him admit that he needs help. Self-knowledge. I don't know about anybody else, but how many Oprah shows did I watch? How many therapists did I go to? How many self-help books did I go to? How many people did I run around to get to co-sign my stuff and tell me what I needed to do? I dated different guys from all different religions because I was like, I'll find somebody. So self-knowledge is going to fix it. And Fred had to go get beat up pretty bad. So they asked Fred, he goes through the story, and my friend pointed this one out one day, and I was like, that is really clever. So he's talking about, you know, he goes there, and all of a sudden the thought crosses my mind. It's been a good day, you know. Everything's resolved. We basically, the government bureau was the IRS, and it turned out okay. So my partner's going to be happy with me. I deserve to celebrate. And then next thing he knows, he's bound for New York, and he finds a taxi cab driver instead of his wife, probably because he called his wife up, you know, wasted out of his mind, and she's like, I'm not coming to pick you up, click, right? And then he goes around, the next thing he's in the asylum again. That, to me, is like, you know, I have to be pretty badly mangled, and thank you, God, that I survived myself. All of us, thank God that we survived ourselves, because I'm guessing that there's other people in this room that have gotten involved in a lot of other dangerous situations, be it substances or be it dangerous situations that you've gotten into, driving drunk, putting yourself in dangerous places with dangerous people, and we're all sitting in this room today because we survived ourselves enough to be able to get here and be willing to have God just give us a little bit of a seed to follow this. So he shows up. I mean, now he's beat up enough. And that's what I had to get to that point, to surrender. That hopeless state of mind and body, that hopelessness in my mind, that there is no way out, was what I needed. Because then it beat me into that, it beat me into the ground of, okay, I'll try anything. And that opened up just enough of a window for that dog whistle for me to hear it. And, you know, I have no doubt that along my journey, before I got into these types of AA meetings, that the dog whistle was probably, somebody was probably blowing it, but I couldn't hear it. I wasn't ready. I wasn't willing to do what I needed to do. And so I don't think that it was just, I got one shot of finding God. I think I just kept on grinding myself up until I got to the point to be beat up. So this is Fred. He gets to the point where now all of a sudden, you know, his self-knowledge and his ego, he's like, all right, I'll listen. So the guys come in and they talk to him. And now all of a sudden, he's like, yeah. And, you know, I had never been able to understand how people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew that it was a crushing blow. Because his ego, my ego, you know. So they outlined the spiritual answer, right? Which is the steps. And, you know, even though he'd only kind of gone to church once in a while, probably Easter and Christmas like me, you know, and the big holidays when I you know, that's for later. Because we're going to get on to the God step next. And he had to throw away some lifelong conceptions, probably asking for help, admitting that he didn't know all the answers, maybe praying, I don't know, you know, but it, lifelong conceptions, you know, I had a few of those myself. And but he said the minute he made up his mind to go through with the process, and process was another word I looked up, a set of actions or changes in a special order, a course of action. So when I was ready to go through that process, I was relieved. And that's how I felt when I asked this woman to help me. I didn't know what I was, but I just had a little bit of relief. And this is a promise. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. And I looked up the word solve. Solve is an effective way to deal with a situation. It doesn't say to get what I want. It doesn't say that everything will be wonderful. It's an effective way to deal with a situation. So when life comes up, because I have these spiritual principles and these tools, I have a way to deal with stuff, which means I don't have to drink. I don't have to implode. I don't have to alienate my family. I don't have to move to California, and I've done that. You know, I have an effective way to deal with stuff. Maybe to stop, maybe pray, maybe call somebody, maybe write a 10-step. I have an effective way to deal with stuff, which does not include numbing myself up because I'm irritable, restless, and discontented. So that promise is that spiritual principles will solve all my problems. And, you know, and I'll end with this. I love this last paragraph where it says, once more, Ronica, it doesn't say my name, but once more, right, just in case all of this reading that you've done, because when they wrote the book, they didn't have meetings, and they were just mailing the book out, other than the house meetings that they were having, right? They would mail the book out to people. So they're like, okay, we've just laid it all out to you. Once more, you have no effective mental defense. It must come from a higher power. So I think that's enough on step one. I've talked a long time, and I'm a big talker. So thank you all for listening today.